20-5577, United States of America versus Daniel J. Zalowski. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Supervising attorney, Ms. Melissa M. Salinas. Arguing today, Ms. Hackley.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Melissa Salinas, and I wanted to thank the court for allowing our student attorney to argue today. I will be supervising Ms. Tacklett. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Salinas.
Good morning, and may
good morning, and welcome once again.
Thank you. Okay. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Lauren Tacklett, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Zalowski. May I please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
You certainly may, and you may proceed.
May we ask you to move your microphone a little bit nearer? We have people listening by tape, and sometimes though at the seats, ones don't pick up as well. Thank you.
Is this better?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you don't. Yeah, it's fine not using your mask while you're arguing, if you're comfortable.
Deferring to our briefs on several issues, I would like to make two main points today. The evidence presented was insufficient as a matter of law to prove Mr. Zalowski's specific intent to persuade a minor to engage in illegal sexual activity. Second, the admitted sexually explicit Pixel phone chats were so prejudicial as to call into question the fairness of the proceedings. I will start with the insufficient evidence of specific intent argument. Mr. Zalowski's expressed interest at the proposed meeting with Detective DeHaunt and the fictitious minors here is not enough to show his intent to persuade under 2422B. In Bailey, this court distinguished between intent to engage in the sexual act and intent to persuade. The government consistently mixed these distinct ideas throughout the trial and its brief, and by saying that Mr. Zalowski's interest in the proposed act evinced his intent to persuade.
Let's pause for a minute. Tell me what the standard is. Isn't the sufficiency of the evidence standard a really difficult standard to satisfy?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. But here we are looking at this from a perspective of a de novo review as a matter of law. Therefore, we believe that here, as a matter of law, the government's evidence only evinced Mr. Zalowski's intent to engage and not his intent to persuade. Therefore, the evidence as presented, even assuming arguendo that it is all admissible, which I defer to our briefs on our issues with that, is not sufficient to meet this standard.
Doesn't intent to engage include intent to persuade to be able to engage?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it does, because if we look at the dictionary definition, as this court has adopted for this statute, intent to persuade is to cause to do something by asking, arguing, or giving reasons. Mr. Zalowski did not do any of that, and specifically did not take these actions with respect to the fictitious minors at issue here. All of his communication was directed solely towards the parent, and this parent, portrayed by Detective DeHaunt, was pushing the conversation forward in a way that did not require persuasion.
So comparable, almost an entrapment argument?
No, Your Honor. We are not saying he was entrapped. But because of the way that these conversations transpired and the active role that Detective DeHaunt played in pushing the conversation forward, Mr. Zalowski never evinced the intent to persuade with the fictitious minors here. I would like to point to the absence of evidence that has been found in other cases that would support such a finding, such as physical evidence of intent, such as money, like was found in Vinton, or the Butterfinger candy from Roman, the lack of asking about the sexual preferences of the minor to make the minor comfortable. This was done in Vinton, Roman, Harmon. He never attempted to communicate with the minor directly, such as asking, "Can I call her?" like was done in Harmon. Instead, this case is most like Nitschke, which was adopted by this court in Harmon, where the DC District Court found insufficient evidence of intent to persuade when the defendant was invited to join an ongoing sexual relationship with a minor.
I understand your position relative to, in effect, the mother was delivering the minors on a silver platter, but when you follow all the conversations, there was discussion of kind of a, we'll work it out when we get there, and who was going to do what to whom and when were all matters to be resolved, and it wasn't clear that the minors necessarily were going to participate in all of the acts that were contemplated, and that there would be some persuasion for them to do so, because that was within the realm of defendant's interest.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't quite understand your question. Is the point that the absence of a specific definite plan is what's at issue here?
No, I'm saying that it wasn't clear that the minors were on board with this. The mother was on board with it, but it wasn't clear that the minors were. And there was some discussion, well, after this happens, then I'll talk to the son and I'll see if he wants to do this and so forth and so on the thing. So, but it was clear right away that he wanted participation from the minors in this drama that was going to unfold.
Your Honor, I disagree that it was clear that he intended for the minors to participate. For example, with Vinton, this court noted that he clearly understood what he was seeking from the get-go because of his communication. Conversely, Mr. Zulawski, when asked by Detective DeHaunt, "What are your ages?" responded with his age, not the age of his preferred sexual partners. That is evincing his lack of clarity about what the situation was from the start. And his continued conversation only evinced his interest at the proposed meeting. It did not evince, to Judge Guy, your point, trying to persuade the minors to engage.
Well, yeah, but the very ad he answered and whatnot even mentioned incest. And he wrote back and said he's always been interested in that and so forth and so on. So it seems to me clear right from the get-go that he expected either minors to participate with each other or that he intended them to also be involved in some sort of relationship with the adults there.
Incest does not inherently equal engaging in illegal sexual activity with minors, by definition. And so I believe that his responses do not speak to his specific intent to persuade a minor, which is what the statute requires. Hence, we do not believe that his responses in the conversations with Detective DeHaunt evince this, specifically noting the lack of evidence of various things that I already listed.
I guess, to follow up on the earlier questions, when we're looking at this matter on appeal, one thing we're examining is whether a reasonable juror could have found Mr. Zulawski intended to, gain the minor's assent. And then inferences, reasonable inferences, would be drawn in favor of the government, I would assume.
Yes.
So as we look at this conversation back and forth and you know, language, which I really don't want to repeat in the courtroom. It looks like there's enough that you mean stitch it together that a jury could find intent based upon asking for photographs of the children, sort of details about the son, fictitious son and daughter, and what would occur, you know, how long have the kids been involved, you know, things of that nature. Just seems, I guess I'm just wondering why when you put all that together, that doesn't create a pretty clear thread that would lead you right to intent.
Assuming arguendo that all evidence presented is admissible, all it evinces is his interest to engage, not his intent to persuade. An intent to persuade is what's at issue here. When looking for intent to persuade, this court has looked at evidence such as asking the communication be passed to the minor, which was not done, asking to communicate directly with the minor, inviting the minor somewhere.
Isn't that presumed? I mean, the mother is speaking on behalf of the children, and that you just sort of presumption that the mother is, as Judge Guy said, sort of serving these fictitious children up on a silver platter. They're not going to have direct contact with Mr. Zelowski in terms of these initial conversations.
One other related question is that you're not making any challenge to the jury instructions that were given in this case, are you?
We are not in our briefs, no.
And I presume that the jury was instructed in, as to what to the elements of the offense were?
Yes, they were, Your Honor.
And so there is some connection between them obviously agreeing that those elements had been met, and those elements would constitute and include the enticement of a minor.
2 points in response to both questions. First, responding to you, Judge Guy. The jury instructions just instructed that persuade, induce, entice in the statute have plain and ordinary meanings. There was no instruction on this delineation between intent to cause versus intent to persuade. So in dealing with the adult in America, therefore, these instructions would not have highlighted the specific nuance that we're discussing here today. In response to Judge...
You know, actually, that answers my question. Did you have another issue you wanted to cover? I'll give you a minute to
yes.
cover that now.
Thank you. I will simply say it was plain error to admit the sexually graphic Pixel phone chats from the days leading up to Mr. Zulawski's arrest. The chats offered little, if any, probative value because they regarded lawful sexual activity with consenting adults. However, they were highly prejudicial because of the explicit descriptions of proposed acts of group sex with as many as 6 people, homosexual acts, and choking during oral sex. The graphic nature of these Pixel phone chats inflamed the jury so much that they convicted Mr. Zulawski for being a sexual deviant, not because he possessed the requisite intent. In a case that turned on the nuanced legal issue of intent to persuade as opposed to intent to cause, the emphasis placed on this highly inflammatory evidence at trial was so prejudicial as to call into question the fairness of the proceedings.
Okay, thank you. You'll have your full rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Will Monahan and I represent the United States in this appeal. Your Honor, turning to the sufficiency argument, which the appellant focused the majority of her argument on, I believe it's clear from the, well, first of all, as the court pointed out, the standard is a very high burden to meet. All inferences that can reasonably be drawn from the evidence must be drawn in the favor of the government. But it's definitely the case that Mr. Zulawski, from that initial response to the ad, is providing information that could be considered persuasive. He's describing himself as a 25-year-old soldier. He's staying in Lexington all week. He's clean, mobile, he can travel, he can do all the things that make it convenient for the person, and that's obviously a way of persuading. Secondly, he clearly makes his interest into incest and in a taboo mom who's 30 years old and who has guests, and the inference here in this lingo of online chats of sexual nature could be that those guests are children, which of course he learns very soon after starting the communications directly back and forth, that those are children. But the photos are the thing that kind of get looked over. He sends photos, he asks for photos, and he continually sends photos throughout the chat, even though they're not requested by Detective DeHaunt. And this fits in with the pattern that we see in some of the other chats. Mr. Zulawski is relying on his youth and appeal as a soldier to help him persuade the person on the other end of the chats, both the mother and the kids, to participate in this conduct. And it's not the case that every photo or chat is only directed at the mother. Some of them do get passed on. In fact, he comments at one point, she says, I think Detective Hunt says, my daughter thinks you're cute. And he says, well, tell her the same. You know. And so the inference there is that certainly messages are getting passed on from the parent to the child, and that information is going back and forth. So it's not the case that there are no communications directed at the kids. In fact, I think the last communication he gives on the night before the rendezvous the next day is, good night to you and the kids. So clearly, you know, it's a simple good night, but it's, you know, he's trying to foster a relationship over these chats in order to make the meeting happen the next day, the sexual rendezvous happen.
Were you the trial attorney?
I was, Your Honor, part of the trial team, two people.
I wondered when I read this why the government felt that they needed all the evidence that's now being objected to. If you just isolate this between him finding the ad, responding to it, the interchange between he and the mother, the trip to the 30-mile trip and his lame excuse, which wasn't completely exculpatory at that, it seems to me you could have quit right there.
Perhaps, Your Honor. I think what was clear from, at least he tried to make clear, was that he had been consistent on that he went there as a rescue operation. At some point in this chat that he determined this was a real scenario with kids and he went there as a rescue operation. He said that in his post-arrest interview, and he said that at trial when he testified. So the United States had to anticipate that he would consistently say that and say it again. So we had to get into the intent. The cage phone chats, the ones that are about the minors that he had exchanged communications with before, and these Pixel phone chats, which we can talk about, but they were definitely part of setting the overall stage for what was going on in his mind, his state of mind at the time, because this transition of his that he claims that he transitioned to a rescue mission, that he was out to save these kids from his mother, doesn't comport with all the other activities that are going on in these chats that we're able to see. And those chats also share some other valuable information about the road conditions being terrible and not able to travel very easily, and the fact that he doesn't have any money, and that he's using his Army credit card for things, so he can't buy condoms to show up with those. At least they would show up on his Army credit card, so he's probably not going to do that. And some other things about his story about inviting her out into the parking lot to talk to her when it's 8 degrees outside. Those texts from the Pixel phone chat, or from the Pixel phone, which is the phone he had on him when he was arrested, basically provide almost real-time information from the time he gets to Lexington and starts these chats and responding to ads up until the point that he's arrested. So it provides the jury a complete picture of what's going on, and that's why the government offered it. And
frankly, did the defendant testify in this case?
Yes, he did, Your Honor, and there's a lengthy a significant cross-examination where if we knew that he was going to testify, and frankly that his, which we can't always anticipate, but that, and when he testified, that his story would kind of crumble, we might not have offered some of the evidence that we offered here, but we can't anticipate that.
Did he attempt to pursue his rescue fantasy when he was testifying in his own behalf?
Yes, Your Honor, he did, and I cross-examined him on that. And I think the fact that it doesn't line up with the other facts in the case. He's having dinner with 6 or 7 other soldiers in his unit at a hotel in Lexington. He's not telling them anything about while he's texting that, hey, we can go the next day and save this person. He doesn't look up anything, you know, the Fayette County Sheriff's or the Franklin County Sheriff's Office, the state police, the FBI, which he actually said he knew enough of because he had been this assistant sexual assault response person in his Army unit. So he had some knowledge of what he should have done here, and on cross-examination, he acknowledged that he didn't do that. He knew better than to take matters into his own hands if that's what he was doing, and he didn't do that. So he didn't follow his own knowledge there about what he was doing. These Pixel phone chats, which I'll talk about because I know the other side brought them up, it actually raised an interesting point. I'm not sure the defense counsel was very competent, and I actually scratched my head myself. Why didn't he object and ask for some redactions on some of these? It wasn't done, and so they all came into evidence. The trial judge redacted the Cage phone chats significantly, or asked the government to do that, and we did that. We did redact the pictures from the Pixel phone chats, so those weren't there. But why were the other chats not objected to? And to be frank, I think it's because they fit in with a strategy or a tactic of the defense counsel here to not have the isolated chat with Detective DeHaan be the only evidence coming in that the defendant is exchanging. Because if you do that, then you see that he's only interacting with a mother and two guests or two children. And so, because if that's the only text that you see, that's the lurid, that's the explicit language. His response to her is explicit. The text refer to sexual acts with the kids, so that's explicit. So if that's the only evidence that comes in, that hurts his client. So that I would argue the defense counsel allowed these other texts because he makes the argument in his opening statement that you're going to hear about these other liaisons with adults, but it sets out a nice contrast for him if he's got eight other chats with adults that are going on. No, my client was just seeking consensual adult activity, and it didn't involve only kids. Only when this one kid's scenario arose did he, you know, click into rescue mode and start to take matters into his own hands. But that's one of the reasons, I think, frankly, that he would have not objected to that. And I think this court is loath to reverse on a plain error standard when the defendant counsel made a tactical decision to allow those chats into evidence. And frankly, I would argue that the prejudice from those chats is not that high. The lurid conduct was clear from the initial response to the ad by Mr. Zalowski. The fact that he's talking about sex with children and the mother is very lurid in itself. Certainly, the government is not contesting there is lurid language in some of these Pixel phone chats, but it is not something that the government focused on in its case. As Your Honor pointed out, there was plenty of other evidence that we did focus on. Certainly, we focused on the Cage phone chats for intent, and we made clear that we were looking at that for the proper purpose under 404B of intent and plan. So we did use those, and we focused on his statements after he was arrested, when he kind of gave a partial confession of being interested in that activity. We focused on his testimony at trial when he testified and tried to cling to this rescue story and how that fell apart. His denial of sending the Cage phone text, which we haven't talked about here, but the jury got to see all of that. And so that's very compelling evidence that he didn't send those texts when there are pictures of his identifying information is in those Cage phone texts to the 14 and 16-year-old children. And all of that information is in those. And even at one point he responds 10 seconds after asked what his kick handle is, he responds within 10 seconds to the person that he's to the 14-year-old that it's Zulu 828, which was never contested at any point that was his kick ID. And so it was very clear, and as in the briefs talked about the sentencing obstruction of justice for perjury, it's very clear that his denial of those Cage phone texts was a critical thing, I think, in the jury assessing his credibility on the stand.
Your opposing counsel argues that there were problems from the beginning in the case because of the language in the initial Army affidavit requesting a warrant. It does seem to me, from listening to that tape and reading the redacted or the most audible part of a transcript, that the statement in that affidavit was just simply incorrect.
Well, I would disagree with you, Your Honor. I think the magistrate judge had a suppression hearing, and the entire calls were played, not just the one call, but some of the other jail court calls as well. And it's a tedious business listening to some of these jail phone calls. But if you take it collectively, it appears that, it's certainly not a direct quote that any evidence, I think it says any evidence against him would be found on his old cellular phones. First of all, I don't think the average people use the word evidence, but nevertheless, he does not say, if they just find my cell phone, you know, that's going to be the thing that's going to get me convicted in this matter. No, that's not what he says. But it wasn't meant to be a direct quote. It's not using quotation marks in the Army warrant. And it is an accurate paraphrase of the fact that he was concerned about being arrested when he returned, and not just concerned, as the appellant argues, about these unregistered guns. There's some, there's definitely some mention of those weapons, but as, and there was some testimony at the suppression hearing, though, about how that's unlikely to be something you would be arrested for on a base where you, in your house, having a weapon. Sure, you're going to get told, you know, go register those or you're in trouble, but you're not going to be arrested for unregistered weapons. But you could be arrested, obviously, and you have to listen to the tape, but he, or the call, he becomes more aggravated as soon as he finds out that they're going through his things at his house, in particular that cage phone, that phone that's that was found in the locked cage, because he knows what's on that phone, and he almost does the Shakespearean "Thou doth protest too much" when he says, "Oh, that phone's broken. That phone doesn't work." You know, he starts going through this when we know that the phone does work, and the things that are recovered from that phone include the multiple chat messages with 14-year-olds and other minors.
I guess I'm just struggling with the fact that the affidavit writer decides for, was that DeHolt? I'm sorry?
DeHaunt.
DeHaunt, thank you. Yeah, decide for herself what these statements in the call meant, as opposed to representing to the requested, in
what
requesting
exactly
the affidavit, what was in fact said.
Right, Your Honor. Well, do recall, Your Honor, that she is conveying what's in the jail phone calls to the Army CID agent who is pursuing that warrant and is signing that. She's not even aware, I believe, that they're seeking a warrant. At that point, she's not directly involved. They're not trading emails about this. It's all over the phone. So she's conveying what she's finding out in real time from these jail phone calls, and the Army CID agent, I think, is taking it on his own to use that information in a warrant. I believe the testimony at the suppression hearing was that he wasn't consulting her. He didn't send it back and say, "Is this right? Did you understand that?" So he, correct, in an ideal world, in a, you know, in a non situation where, you know, attorneys are writing it or there's more time, but this was in the heat of an investigation. We've got multiple scenes. We've got the person in Frankfurt, the house in Fort Campbell where the other evidence is being sought, and evidence goes disappearing all the time. So they need to pursue this warrant, and they do. But you're right, Your Honor, it is a paraphrase of something that is not exactly what was said. And of course, that's not the only warrant, because again, Detective DeHaunt.
Your real argument is maybe we did do it wrong.
No.
But the second warrant cleans it up because it doesn't reference those conversations?
I think the second warrant does clean up any difficulty. I would not concede, and the government doesn't concede, that it was done incorrectly, but for the first warrant. But certainly Detective DeHaunt, who was more familiar with the state system and more, and it was her case, it became her case, or it was decided that it would be, you know, pursued civilly and not through the military justice system, then she sought a different warrant from the Franklin County District Judge that had nothing to do with these jail calls, and that warrant, we believe, stands up to any kind of criticism. If there are no further questions, then I think the United States will rest on our briefs. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you, Counsel. Ms. Tacklett, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to make two main points in this rebuttal. First, insinuating a child could be persuaded to engage in sex with an adult because the adult is attractive is a highly problematic argument. Mr. Zulawski did not ask for his photos to be passed to the minors. Instead, this is an example of Detective DeHaunt leading him, similar to the issues with the warrant that were just being discussed. Where,
let me ask you one thing that struck me as a very significant piece of evidence, is that he specifically, in speaking about the children, he specifically asked if they were as excited as we are. Now, why is that not, in light of all the other facts, sufficient to show that his intent was to persuade the children?
Your Honor, that does not speak to
his intent to persuade the children, only his interest and excitement over the proposed meeting. When the statute explicitly is criminalizing persuasion, the act of solicitation, that is what matters here, not general interest or excitement. Does that answer your question?
It's a tough line to make when you have that kind of statement.
It is. However, in this case, on these facts, the absence of evidence of intent to persuade, we believe, is overwhelming here based on the other factors that were previously discussed. And so if there was a case to find this lack of intent, these are the facts to find it on. Secondly, I would just like to quickly point on the rescue attempt. The fact that he sought sex from consenting adults around the same time does not inherently contradict that he also intended that to protect these children. But even assuming, arguendo, that these chats had limited probative value, there were less invasive means that could have shown these specific items that the government points to. And the graphic nature of the messages, without any sort of limiting redaction or instructions, makes the evidence so prejudicial as to call into question the fairness of the proceedings. In Delaney, we made clear that it is the lurid and explicit nature of the language that must be taken into account when considering prejudicial impact. I see I am out of time. May I briefly conclude?
Yeah, very briefly, please.
We request your honors find that it was insufficient as a matter of law for Mr. Zulofsky to prove intent to persuade a minor to engage in illegal sexual activity, and the court made a plain error which called into question the fairness of the proceedings when it admitted the sexually explicit Pixel phone chats. We rely on our briefs for the remainder of the issues. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you both for your arguments this morning. We really do appreciate them, and certainly would like to thank and recognize the University of Michigan Law School for taking on this matter, and Ms. Salinas for supervising, and Ms. Tacklett for doing excellent job this morning in presenting argument on behalf of Mr. Zulofsky and what is obviously a multi-factor challenging case with many issues, but very much appreciate arguments from both sides here, and we'll take the matter under advisement. And again, thank you very much.
I'd like to just say amen to that, because the program, you do an excellent job. And I also want to say that David Moran was one of my former law clerks, so he's been very integral in all some of this areas that you have going on there. Thank you.
I'll note that I think that Ms. Salinas is a clerk of Judge Clay. Well, anyway, thank you very much.